Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. At President Obama's press conference in Turkey on Monday, American journalists pressed him on whether the U.S. military would take more action in Syria and send in troops. After different versions of the same questions, CNN's Jim Acosta said, quote, "I guess the question is, and if you'll forgive the language, why can't we take out these bastards?" End quote. In the days following, the conversation turned to national security and the refugee crisis. Yesterday, almost every House Republican and 47 Democrats voted for a bill that would make it even more difficult for refugees from Syria and Iraq to enter the U.S. The final vote was 289 to 137. The bill would require the Secretary of Homeland Security, the FBI Director, and the Director of National Intelligence to each certify that a refugee was not a threat to national security before they were admitted to the United States. That majority vote could override the president's promised veto. This week, the administration released new details about how they are investigated, how refugees are investigated. The screening process can take nearly 3 years. So where is reporting about that? The AP reports that the process takes so long that experts said it would be unlikely for an extremist group to rely on a refugee program to sneak someone into the United States. The Guardian and McClatchy have reported on the lengthy and in-depth screening process. But with this vote, why isn't this getting more attention? Joining us to talk about coverage of these issues is Mark Seibel, Chief of Correspondence and Foreign Editor with McClatchy Newspapers. McClatchy reporters won several awards for their reporting in the lead-up to the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. They were one of the few outlets to provide skeptical coverage of the Bush administration's claims about weapons of mass destruction. And we have asked this question so many times on this show, but what have reporters actually learned? Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show. We are also joined in studio by Danny McLean, a contributing writer for The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. Her latest piece is about long-term reversible contraception pilot programs in St. Louis, Missouri, and Colorado. In her piece, Long-Acting Contraception Makes Teen Pregnancy Rates Plummet, Why are women skeptical? She writes, quote, "The history of birth control in America is littered with instances of coercion. Reproductive justice advocates don't want to see that happen again." And Danny joins me in studio. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the show. Nice to see you.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday's media roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Danny, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
So I have been following the work of Alia Malik, who until recently was a senior writer at Al Jazeera America. And I thought this week Alia did something really interesting on social media to respond to the current conversation around Syrian refugees. She writes about Syria and the Middle East more broadly. And over the weekend, she on Facebook posted something that was, you know, kind of a personal take on these issues. She said that on Thursday, she wrote to her friends in Beirut to ask whether everyone there was safe after the attacks. On Friday, she reached out to her friends in Paris to make sure they were okay. And since many of them are French citizens who of heritage from ex-French colonies in Africa, she was doubly worried about their safety. She said, "Much more frequently, I ask the same of my relatives in Syria, who are never really safe anymore. I only wish the world and Facebook with its check-in button and even some of my friends here with their feeds could empathize with all of these wonderful people and care about their safety equally." And I just thought it was such a personal and authentic, she just had such an authentic touch to this issue that's really been in the forefront recently. Why is it that, you know, people seem to be able to empathize so much more with the victims and the families in Paris who were affected by these attacks, more so than so much of the violence, you know, more so than with victims of violence elsewhere? Alia took it a step further when she started tweeting at Governor Larry Hogan on Tuesday. So on Tuesday, Larry Hogan, who is the Republican governor of Maryland, announced that he would ask the federal authorities to halt the ability of Syrian refugees to come into Maryland. Alia is from Baltimore, and she started tweeting at him and said, "I'm born and raised in our great state of Maryland. My parents immigrated from Syria to Baltimore in 1969 and 74. She went on to do a series of tweets in which she talked about, you know, her sister is a doctor at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Her brother is a Princeton grad who served AmeriCorps. So making this point, you know, we are Syrian immigrants to this country. And, you know, when you talk about the current wave of Syrian refugees, as if you have some reason to fear and the great state of Maryland, you know, should reject them, know that you're speaking to us as Maryland residents and as Maryland voters. And I just thought it was an example of someone who works in media using her platform mm-hmm. to make a really important set of positions. And I look, arguments, and I look forward to her book on Syria coming out next year.
Did the governor respond to any of her
tweets? I don't think he's responded.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure, but I don't think that he has responded.
And you bring this up, Danny, and I just wonder, as a journalist, someone who reads a lot of news, like all of us, that angle has since been analyzed over and over again. Why is Paris getting more attention than Beirut? Why is there a check-in box mm-hmm. on Facebook? For those of you who don't know or maybe don't use Facebook, right after the attacks, I noticed this. Right when I logged onto Facebook, it said, this friend and this friend and this friend, they're all safe. Because if you live in France, there was a button that you were allowed, that you were asked to check if you were okay, but they don't have that in Beirut. And I think Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has since talked about it and said they're going to add it in Kenya and other places where there are attacks.
That's great. I mean, I think it's, I think that this is the beauty of social media, right? It gives people an opportunity to clap back or to talk back and say, you know, to institutions like Facebook or like, you know, U.S. governors and say, the way that you're responding to this situation doesn't work for us, doesn't, you know, reflect the realities that we live. And it's good to see, I hadn't heard that about Zuckerberg. It's good to hear that Facebook may be making some changes as a result.
So kudos to Alia Malik, and we will put a link to her piece at yourcallradio.org. That's Danny McLean, contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a fellow at The Nation Institute. And Mark Seibel, are you with us?
I am now, yes.
Okay, great. Hi, Mark. Welcome
to
the show.
Thank you.
Great to have you. So what did you see this week, Mark, that you thought was done well?
Well, the piece I actually have been wandering around quoting is a Washington Post piece that appeared in last Friday's papers, I believe, a week ago. And the headline on it was, Time for GOP Panic. Establishment worried Carson or Trump might win. And it's a... you know, it's another look at the angst within the Republican Party as they realize that their two leading candidates are very much outside of the mainstream of at least the establishment Republican thought. And what I particularly liked about it was talking about strategists who were terrified that not only would Trump or Carson end up being the nominee, but they might actually win the election. Mm. And that would be even worse. And I think it is a very interesting discussion among Republicans about the concerns they have that their two leading candidates are really not people you want to have in the White House. And it's just an interesting example of reaping what one sows. And was just a fascinating look at angst among Republican Republican strategists, and it plays into what we were just talking about. Because if you look at the statements that have been coming out of Trump's and Carson's mouths for the last few days, they are very almost hateful about Syrian refugees.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you brought this up, Mark. Since you're on this, let's just dive right in here, because Donald Trump is calling for a database to track Muslims living in the United States. Ben Carson is suggesting that refugees should be screened as they might be rabid dogs. How should the media report on these, let's call them for what they are, these racist comments? I mean, do you think the media should use that word? How should they report on this?
Well, it's a difficult thing for a reporter or, let's say, a mainstream organization, because, you know, we don't normally characterize things as racist or that sort of thing. We let the fact speak for itself, and people can make their own judgment about it. What I do think is important is that as we report on what Carson says, what Trump says, we need to also report the context of that. We've seen countries where they have had separate IDs based on religion. We know, obviously, the Nazi Germany experience with basically having all Jews wear stars, and we know what it was like in Iraq when people had on their ID card Sunni or Shia, and how easy it made it for them to be targeted. We had a piece today that Hannah Allam wrote talking about the fear among Muslims that this hate speech from the Republican candidates is making what is already a rise in attacks on Muslims worse. People are afraid. And it's, you know, I think you have to go out and explore those issues while you're letting Carson speak or Trump speak, or for that matter, Cruz and Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush saying that we should only let in Christians. I mean, really? You know, that's a pretty incredible statement. Only Christians should be allowed into the United States.
Well, and Mark, these guys have a very loud microphone. Anytime I turn on the radio, I'm hearing from them. And so how should the media report on that and then connect the dots to the fact that words matter? Because this is getting a lot of attention. I'm reading right now from a CBS News piece. Muslims around the U.S. are facing backlash following the deadly attacks in Paris, including vandalism to mosques and Islamic centers, hate-filled phone and online messages, and threats of violence. And I am seeing so many posts on social media of women wearing the veil who are being punched, they're being yelled at. I mean, they're walking around in fear again. So, you know, what are your thoughts about how the media should connect these dots?
Well, I think you keep pointing out that that's what happens and that there is a relationship between words and incitement. That is what happens, and you have to keep pressing the candidates to talk about it. They don't seem to be chastened at all when asked about it. They sort of doubled down on it. Trump did the other day when he was pressed on how far we should go in tracking Muslims and monitoring their movements and that sort of thing. And his response was, well, there might be some things that we'll have to do that we wouldn't have done a year ago.
What role should the media play to make sure these kinds of comments are not normalized?
Well, you know, the thing that's a little worrisome is that the comments, I'm not sure the media can prevent them from being normalized. I mean, you have to just keep pointing out the history, and you have to go to people who will talk about how problematic comments like this can be, and track the violence and all those kinds of things, and remind people of history, where there have been states like Nazi Germany where it became the norm, and it's not that Germans were particularly brutal people. They just became inured to the idea that because all their leadership talked about it, that, well, of course, Jews are subhuman people, you know, and so what's the next step in that? But I think it's up to the news media to remind people of those historical precedents and to put these candidate comments in that context to try and bring the message home. Ultimately, you know, the only way that does not become part of the theory is voters turning out and not putting these people into office, and that's where that's what you have to ultimately hope for. You know, I don't know what happens if we discover that 69% of Americans think that's a good idea.
That is Mark Seipel. Mark is Chief of Correspondence and Foreign Editor at McClatchy Newspapers. We're also joined by Danny McLean, Contributing Writer for The Nation and Fellow at The Nation Institute. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What did you make of the, or what do you make of the ongoing coverage of the terrorist attacks in Paris? There's so much attention also now about the refugee crisis. Did you catch the press conference on Monday where so many American journalists pressed President Obama on whether the U.S. military would send troops to Syria? Where are you seeing good reporting? Is anybody questioning the status quo and the, quote, war on terror? We talked about this earlier this week, and you can find that show at yourcallradio.org, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. I want to ask you, Mark, about Monday's press conference in Turkey. American journalists asked President Obama basically different versions of the same question. So Jim Avila, ABC, if I could ask you to address your critics who say that your reluctance to enter another Middle East war and your preference of diplomacy over using the military makes the U.S. weaker and emboldens our enemies. Margaret Brennan with CBS, will you widen the rules of engagement for U.S. forces to take more aggressive action? And then this one from CNN. After his colleagues asked the same questions, he said, why can't we take out these bastards? What did you think of these questions, Mark? And if you were there, what would you have asked?
Well, you know, here's the thing, and I always have to remember this. You know, journalists do ask a lot of provocative questions in hoping to get an answer that isn't just pro forma. So some of this is that. And because it's televised, I don't know, should we ask less provocative questions? I mean, these are questions that people want to know. Why, and you know, the why can't we take these bastards out? I mean, my wording might have been different on that, because I might have said, why is it that our effort to diminish the Islamic State seems to have failed? And I think there's plenty of arguments that would say that's the case. But I do think, in general, about the coverage and about that kind of tone, that the Washington news media in general has been pro-interventionist and in Syria. And I do think it would be good. And I see this from Matt Lee, who covers the State Department for the Associated Press. He has a very provocative way of questioning the State Department spokesperson every day about, well, you've said this about Syria, but it's not true. Or isn't this aren't you sorry of saying Assad's days are numbered? Did you think it would be 400 days, 500 days when you were talking about how many days Assad would stay in power? So provocative questions are intended to get provocative answers. But I'm not sure that we've asked questions about American policy and how realistic what we are hearing from our own officials about the situation in Syria, how effectively we've questioned that.
Well, and so how should the media do that, Mark? I mean, what question would you ask? Because the guests that were on our show on Wednesday said, if the largest military and most powerful military in the world cannot bomb ISIS out of existence, we hear that a lot, then what makes the French government and the Russian government think that they can? And why isn't anyone questioning this long-term policy that doesn't seem to be working? Are you hearing that in Washington, D.C.? Are reporters asking those questions?
Well, I think so. I think we're asking those questions every day about, you know, why would these campaigns or the Russian campaign be any different from the American campaign? I think the sense here, the subtext here is that somehow we haven't been trying, you know, hard enough. If we would just try a little bit harder. But if you read, you know, the what's been written about it, I mean, the answer is fairly obvious, is that you cannot win a war like this with an aerial campaign. You know, now, where does that lead us? Well, it leads us to boots on the ground. Well, should America put boots on the ground? Obama has said no. the interesting thing is that we have had some success in northeastern Syria, where we've worked with the Kurds, the YPG, which is a Syrian Kurdish militia that the Turks are very hostile to, but we have given them air support, and they have taken back 7,000 square miles of northeastern Syria that had been part of the Islamic State area of control. So there is some movement here that is working. Obama likes to say that, and then, of course, there's something like Paris that happens shortly thereafter that undercuts that argument. But I think what the discussion is in Washington, and people talk about it, is that aerial campaigns alone don't have a very good track record. And so the talk is boots on the ground. So what boots get on the ground? And Obama's line has been, well, we're looking for the local forces. And unfortunately, in both Iraq, or maybe fortunately, depending on your perception, in Iraq and Syria, we found Kurdish forces to be effective on the ground. And so we work with them. And it is a kind of a long haul. We have not found the Iraqi forces to be anywhere near as successful. And of course, the topic that nobody really pushes here is that perhaps it's time to team up with the Russians, team up with the French, maybe even team up with the Assad government, and focus on what we can do to help the other forces on the ground, meaning the Syrian army, do their thing against ISIS. And that's really anathema in Washington. Though we did hear it from Hillary Clinton in New York the other day, where she basically said it's time to recognize that the time for regime change with Assad has passed, and that Assad can't be the priority. ISIS has to be the priority. And that would be a change for American policy.
Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence and foreign editor with McClatchy Newspapers. Danny McLean is a contributing writer for The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. We've got a number of callers on this issue, so let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, morning, Rose, and your guest. You know, I'm glad I finished or following up with your guest there. I'm seeing conflicting stories coming from the neocons about who we're fighting and why we're fighting. Hypothetically, we're supposed to be allies with Russia, yet John McCain is claiming that we have to fight Russia. And actually, on October 1st, he was recommending that we arm ISIS and al-Qaeda in order to fight Russia. And when you realize that John McCain is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he's recommending that we support ISIS and al-Qaeda to fight the Russians, you got to realize that there's insanity at work there.
Mark, quick response before we go to break.
Well, my quick response to that is that a lot of things that are being proposed in Washington don't really make much sense. It depends on what your priority is, and with John McCain, his priority has always been toppling Assad, and with a lot of people in Washington, that's been the priority. So anything that will benefit that is okay. And you might remember the Obama administration in 2013, they thought the Islamic State was on their side. It was on the side that wanted to topple Assad. It was not till 2014 that it dawned on everybody, oh, these people are really dangerous. Kind of late to the party, actually.
Well, thank you for calling in, and we've got a number of calls on the line. We'll get some more right after we get back from a break. This is Your Call. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our media roundtable. We are talking about media coverage of the attacks in Paris. We're talking about the response, questions from reporters, the refugee crisis. Also, House Republicans, almost every House Republican and 47 Democrats yesterday, voted for a bill that would make it even more difficult for refugees from Syria and Iraq Iraq to enter the United States. The administration has released new details about how refugees are investigated. The AP reports that the process takes so long, almost 3 years, that experts say it would be unlikely for an extremist group to rely on the refugee program to sneak someone into the United States. So if you're seeing that coverage, we'd love to hear from you. And if you can also make sure to keep your questions about the media, we would greatly appreciate it. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence and foreign editor with McClatchy Newspapers. Danny McLean is contributing writer for The Nation. And in about 10 minutes, we will talk about her latest piece about long-term reversible contraception pilot programs in St. Louis, Missouri, and Colorado. They're being touted as major success stories, but some women are very skeptical about them. We'll talk about why that is. Again, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. There are two stories that I actually wanted to highlight that we might want to look at. One is the four former operators of drones who are in an open letter to Obama, declared that the whole drone warfare program has been ineffective, has created countless collateral damage casualties, and we really should be taking a second look at that. And the other one was a frontline TV program this past week on ISIS in Afghanistan, which should scare the pants off of anybody who watched that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I have been following these four former U.S. Air Force service members who are whistleblowers. They've got more than 20 years of experience between them operating drones, and they wrote an open letter to President Obama warning that the program of targeted killings by drones has become a major driving force for ISIS. They wrote, quote, "We validate them. We keep the cycle going. Their children are afraid to play out in the sun because that's when the drones are coming." And Mark, this has received coverage by The Guardian. Democracy Now! Had the four young men on its show this morning. It's received coverage in Free Speech Radio News and one other outlet. The name escapes me. It's not getting much coverage. Why not?
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is, of course, none of us like to follow on somebody else's news report. The other is, I think for many of us who follow this issue, having four more people tell us that drones cause terrorism is not news. It's interesting, and these are people who are worth hearing from, and depending on the way you would approach it, it could be a very good story. But, you know, going back to 2012, 2013, there has been lots and lots of discussion of how the drone program is really counterproductive. That it kills too many innocent people, in spite of the assessment that they're very precise, and we've never killed any innocent person in a drone attack, et cetera. I mean, we did a story, I guess it's been 2 years ago, about how that just simply wasn't true, and we had some records from the intelligence community themselves that showed that they, A, didn't really know who they were hitting, B, that there was lots of damage. And then that, of course, there was a group in Pakistan of journalists who basically went through all the drone strikes and came up with very compelling studies about how many civilians, non-fighters, were killed in drone strikes. And so it's not unusual, to me anyway, to hear the argument that drones create terrorists. The drone program is highly suspect on that issue. And in fact, you know, even in Syria recently, these are not so much drones, but just U.S. airstrikes. We've done some reporting about the number of civilians that are killed in these. And we had a guy who used to work for us. He's a Syrian who no longer works for us. But he wrote a very powerful essay about how every civilian killed turns somebody against the United States. Mm.
But, Mark, do you think this is common knowledge among the public? I don't hear many people talking about this.
I don't know, because I don't know how much people have engaged in the drone issue, except that from the standpoint of the president. This is always the problem. I mean, when the president or the public official gets up and touts the drones as the great high-tech thing that they are, and they show the video and all that, and it's all very exciting. I don't think that they read the sidebars and the follow-up stories or watch the deeper thought process stories about what goes on. I would agree. I don't think the public is engaged, but I think it's not because there hasn't been coverage of the subject. I think it's just that people look at the, you know, what happened now, what the president said today, and then tomorrow when it's examined, they sort of moved on to something else.
Well, in the Democracy Now! Interview, Jesselyn Raddick, who's director at the Government Accountability Project, she's representing the four former drone operators, and she said that these guys might be prosecuted by the Obama administration because she said that a group of four former drone operators has never come out publicly and made this connection.
Well, I think it's, I mean, that's quite possible. I suspect that drone operators, while they appreciate this, would not be very prone to talk about it. Maybe because, you know, that would be a serious work conflict. And I don't know whether they would be punished for it, but I could see how psychologically it would be an issue for them.
Well, we have a caller who would like to be anonymous. Hi, welcome to the show. Hello? All right. Let's take one more call on this. Let's go to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I have such a mixed feelings about the media. In one way, I think it's wonderful. It's done so much good for this country. In another way, it has done so much bad for this country. Now, what I'm referring to is how it generates fear in the public. We all know about the domino theory in the Vietnam War. Now, we also know about the Iraq War and how the administration was repeating the same thing, and the press was going, capturing it. They were saying about the mushroom cloud, trying to develop this fear in the American public, and now we're doing it again with the Syrians. I once asked somebody, can we allow 20,000 children in here? Would you object to Syrian children coming in? Well, he said no, and that would not be a problem. But if you look back in history, and this is so important for the people to follow, during World War II, we didn't allow 20,000 Jewish children in because of fear we had about Jews in this country. So if the press, you know, this is the part which I'm sure they understand, and all the boardrooms, they talk about it. If you keep on highlighting the people who are pushing fear, you're going to cause the public to be fearful. Just modify that. Show a counter for it. When you have somebody talking about how we should be afraid, have someone on or in the press, on television, radio, or in the written press, give a counter-argument. It's just very dangerous for a country to succumb to fear like this country has.
Well, and let me ask you this, because it sounds like, I mean, you call in many times. You sound like you listen to the media and watch the media regularly. Are you hearing anybody on the radio shows or on television who's challenging this narrative?
No, unfortunately. Well, yes, yesterday there was one man on KGO in the afternoon. He challenged it. He was beginning to wonder why we were using the Syrians and using so much fear to generate against them. It's rare, though. They want to talk about Trump and his rhetoric, which is like insane. He was talking about having people having them register and have all the Muslims in the country register. He was talking about bombing everything he could see in that, those countries that would support ISIS. It's just like an insanity that's come over this country, and I just worry about it. But the only thing that can stop it is the press, the media. And if if they just sit on their hands and enjoy the show, we're going to have some trouble, particularly if Trump gets in.
Hmm. Well, thank you. I mean, Mark, I think a lot of people are really frustrated.
Well, it's a dilemma. I think, you know, when you look at, and to be honest, I have not watched much of the television coverage because I've been too busy working our own coverage on the subjects. But part of the problem is the nature of especially our cable television networks, where they often do polemics, and the best TV is the people with the most extreme opinion, and so some of that is reflected here, I think, in this discussion. When a presidential candidate gets up and says something like that, and he's not just a presidential candidate, he is the leading presidential candidate of the party out of power in one branch of government, then you have to pay attention to it. You have to write about it. You have to get it out there. And yet you're publicizing a position that I think many people in news media think is, as your caller said, just crazy. And yet how do we ignore it? You can't just ignore it, because then his outrageous statements when he gets elected, people say, well, you guys ignored what he was saying that was so outrageous. And you have to have some faith that the American people can listen to that and decide for themselves, this is not a person I want to support, or this is a person I want to support. That might be worse, but I don't know how in the news media we ignore it. You can just simply provide context, lots of historical looks, and hope that people read those.
Well, with this vote in the House for a bill that would make it even more difficult for refugees from Syria and Iraq to enter the U.S., we're not getting now as many stories as we were about just the sheer suffering that so many people are going through around the globe. And we are in the process of putting a show together about the refugees. So thank you again for joining us, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye. That is Mark Seibel. He's chief of correspondence and foreign editor with McClatchy Newspapers. And Dani McLean is in studio. She's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a fellow at The Nation Institute. And we are going to talk about Dani's latest piece. It's about long-term reversible contraception. It's a pilot program that took place in St. Louis, Missouri, and Colorado. And so many people who were involved in these programs called them overwhelming success stories. Now, hear this percentage. In Colorado, the teen birth rate and the teen abortion rate both dropped 48% over 5 years. Healthcare providers and researchers have made the IUD available at low or no cost, and obviously proven highly, highly effective. In Colorado, this program was funded by a foundation. And so, Dani, first off, these numbers, when you just look at the numbers, they're incredible. Cutting the abortion rate almost in half.
Right. So it's interesting, Rose, because on your show, you always talk, about the need to be skeptical about what the media is telling us. And really, this story idea came out of my surprise and skepticism when I was reading these headlines coming out of Colorado and St. Louis, these pilot programs that were so celebratory about the success of these programs through which the long-acting reversible contraceptives, and that's a LARCs is what they're called, and that refers to IUDs and hormonal implants. So these stories were, talking about these statistics that you just mentioned, cutting the teen birth rate, teen abortion rate by half in Colorado. And what stuck out to me was, okay, that's interesting. And you're providing these very expensive forms of birth control to low income and poor women, either for free or at very low cost. But what does that, what's the perspective of the women who are in these programs? And I was hearing conversations coming out of the reproductive justice movement of people tying, making comparisons between LARC and, for example, Norplant in the early 1990s. So Norplant was a capsule that was inserted beneath the skin of a woman's arm, and by a provider, right? These are all provider-controlled methods of birth control. And the day after the FDA approved this method, there was a editorial in the Philadelphia Inquirer saying, this is fantastic. Maybe we should make this form, use of this form of birth control, tie it to receipt of welfare benefits so that women can't, you know, get their welfare benefits unless they agree to use this long-acting provider, controlled form of birth control. So I was hearing these kind of conversations within among certain activists, mostly Black and Latino women, who were saying, well, this is great on one hand because we're making this highly effective, right? 99% effective when you're talking about the IUD or the hormonal implant versus the pill, which is 91% effective, or condoms 82% effective. It's great that, you know, the healthcare providers are making this highly effective form of birth control that's also quite expensive, right? Often upwards of $500 available to poor women. But we have to remember that there's a history of reproductive coercion in this country, and we don't want LARCs to fall within that same tradition.
Now, a number of clinics in Colorado have taken part in this pilot program. Did you speak with any women of color who are counseling these women or working with these women? And did you ask them about the concerns that, that people raised in conversations with you?
Well, I spoke to Dr. Stephanie Teal. She runs the she ran the statewide Colorado program. She's not a woman of color, but she ran the statewide program, and she continues to run a kind of scaled back version of the LARC program out of the clinic that she directs. It's a scaled back version because the state decided not to allocate funding to continue the statewide program. So she's able to continue this program through private donations. She was adamant that, look, there's nothing coercive happening here. You know, the young women that she sees are incredibly excited that there's this what they call set it and forget it method of birth control, meaning once the doctor puts it in, you know, you don't really have to think much about it. It's not like the pill that you have to remember to take every day or the condom that you have to remember to use every time you have sex. So she's saying, you know, look, there's nothing coercive happening. We didn't do some huge marketing campaign. Really, this is, you know, young women are coming to us because they've heard from their sisters or their cousins that this is available for free. I also talked to a health researcher out of here, San Francisco. His name is Dr. Daniel Grossman, who was part of a study of 800 women in Texas. They gave birth, and these are 800 women who had recently given birth in Austin and El Paso, and they were asked, you know, 6 months after delivery, what form of birth control they were using. And these are women who said that they for sure did not want to have another child for at least 2 years. A third of the women said that they like to be using a long-acting reversible method, but only 13% were doing so. And when I asked Dr. Grossman why that was the case, he pointed out that women with household incomes more than $75,000 are 11 times more likely to use LARCs than those with household incomes less than $10,000. So really, this is an issue about money. What women with who, you know, have higher incomes have the ability to go to private doctors who may feel more comfortable and more familiar with the IUD, know how to use it, and, you know, they have the ability to pay for this more expensive form of birth control. That said, I mean, so, you know, these are two health researchers and, you know, doctors who are saying, look, there's nothing coercive happening. This is an issue of making this more accessible. That is one perspective, but I also talked to people who pointed out that, you know, there is evidence that people feel pressured and that, you know, a low-income Black or Latino woman is more likely to feel that her doctor is pressuring her to limit her family size than a similarly situated white woman. So, you know, I'm actually quite proud of this article because it shows that this is a very complex issue. I mean, I think that there's a history of coercion in this country, whether you're looking at forced sterilization in women's prisons, just as recently here in California. These are California women's prisons where people were being forcibly sterilized as recently as 2010. You know, the history of Norplant, which I mentioned. You know, so there there is a history and a context in which we need to view this, but there's also, some would say, evidence that this is really about equaling, you know, leveling the playing field when it comes to birth control access.
This has received so much attention because the abortion rate was cut in half in just 5 years. And then once the foundation funding ran out, a Colorado Republican who used to be a school teacher and understands poverty introduced a bill with a Democrat to continue the funding. And, of course, the Republicans voted it down, saying that IUDs are an abortifacient. So I understand the coverage because you're thinking, if we had, like you said, birth control access, equal access across the field and across the country, can you imagine how much power so many women would have, especially poor women? So, you know, how did you come at it kind of thinking about that angle? Because when I saw the story, I thought, oh my gosh, what if we had this in all 50 states?
Yeah. Yeah, and to be clear, so the pilot program that's gotten a ton of attention is the statewide one in Colorado, and then there was the Choice Project out of Washington University in St. Louis. But I was speaking with a radio reporter in New Mexico this week. They're about to launch a program there in New Mexico. I'm pretty sure that, you know, New York City just launched a huge IUD public health program. So this is really starting to be all over the place. It's often happening on the local level, but I think what's important is that really the solution or the way forward that I found through my reporting, it really comes down to birth control counseling and how how healthcare providers are talking to women about their options. So traditionally, there's something called the informed choice approach to counseling women about birth control. And what that looks like is that you offer a kind of menu of options with no real hierarchy to it. So your doctor might say, okay, so there's the pill, and obviously you'll need to take that every day, and this is what the side effects might look like. There's the, you know, you might use condoms, you might think about the Depo-Provera shot, you might think about the IUD. What that approach to birth control counseling has recently been, it's kind of being eclipsed by an approach called the tiered effectiveness approach. And what that means is that a provider begins the conversation by suggesting what's most effective in preventing pregnancy. So there's this, so in that case, in that type of conversation, the provider will lead with talking about LARC, will lead with talking about the IUD, the hormonal implant, and will kind of go down the list based on what's most effective. The issue with that is that not every person chooses a form of birth control based on what's more effective, right? People have other considerations. Maybe they don't like the way that hormones work in their bodies. Maybe they don't want to get their period, you know, maybe they want to have more control over when they get their period. Maybe they want to use something that their partner can't detect. And so what I learned in talking to healthcare providers is that a way to kind of deal with the potential for coercion, the possibility that some type of coercive conversation would take place, is to take a more woman-centered approach to these birth control counseling conversations, in which a healthcare provider tailors their counseling script to support a patient's own family planning and health priorities. So that would mean that instead of like running through this script that starts with the IUD, for example, the healthcare provider would say, what's most important to you? What are you looking for in your birth control? What are your health concerns that you want to keep in mind as we have this conversation about how you're how you're controlling your family size?
Do you think that this is going to get more traction because now these pilot programs are taking place? And I remember talking to a Planned Parenthood health provider who said, you know, we're doing a really bad job of telling people about the IUD. Everybody talks about the pill. We don't talk enough about the IUD, and a lot of women think it's not safe.
Right.
So what are your thoughts about how reporters should cover contraception, which is such an important topic?
Right. I mean, so I think that, yes, I think that this is going to be getting a lot more traction. I mean, so the thing about the IUD in this country, it's interesting when I speak to my friends who are, European or from elsewhere, they're like, of course we use the IUD. Like, yeah, that's what, you know, I've been using the IUD since I was 16. We have a different history with that in this country because of the Dalcon Shield, which was a type of IUD that was available in the 70s and ended up leading to pelvic inflammatory disease and really infertility, and even caused more than a dozen deaths in women before it was banned in 1974. So we have a really different history of kind of openness to the IUD in this country, and that's really what's changing right now as a result of these pilot programs. I think that I think that that's great and that's fine, but there needs to be an understanding of the kind of stories that some women bring to using provider-controlled methods. So just one example, I talked to a young woman, Elizabeth Dawes Gray, who was very, this is a young Black woman, was very certain that she wanted the IUD. She went to Planned Parenthood and said, I've done all my research. I know that I want the IUD. She got her IUD. She was very happy with it. She went home and was talking to a relative about it. And the relative, and this is an older relative of hers, said, well, aren't you scared? And Elizabeth said, no, this is what I wanted. And the relative said, but the nurse who put it in for you is white. Aren't you worried that she may have done something to you? So we have to be, I mean, and I think some healthcare providers would like roll their eyes and be like, that's just being crazy. But there is a, because, you know, there are these histories of, you know, women not seeing birth control as a path toward reproductive freedom, but instead seeing birth control as a way that some people want to reduce populations that are not considered desirable. That's real. And I think if we're going to expand these IUD programs and these LARC programs, we have to take that history into consideration.
Well, we have to do a show about this because we did not have time to talk about this Texas Policy Evaluation Project
right.
study that found between 100,000 and 240,000 women in Texas may have tried to end their pregnancies without medical help.
Because of all these clinic closures that are happening.
Exactly. Dani McLean is a contributing writer for The Nation and a fellow with The Nation Institute. You can find her piece at yourcallradio.org. Dani, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss what happens when children are socialized by robots. Mattel recently unveiled the new Hello Barbie. It's a Wi-Fi-enabled interactive talking doll. Hello Barbie remembers children's likes and dislikes, family details, and generates responses to engage them in conversation. With over 8,000 lines of recorded content ready to go, is this doll promoting genuine conversation or isolation? And how does technology affect our children's emotional development? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.